Whatever the adventure, there's a BMW engineered to take it on. The X3 delivers a striking design with agile performance. The 100% electric i4, packed with pure electric energy. Or the plug-in hybrid X5, an impressive, versatile SUV granting full control on every journey. Choose what powers your next adventure during the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Fantasy freaks and geeks, it's James Kell from the Sleeper King Football Podcast. We all know sleepers can win you championships, but finding these guys takes time. That's where the Sleeper King comes in. Let me do all the research so you don't have to. Every week, I'm going to break down which sleepers you need to pick up off the waiver wire and which surprise deep sleepers could help you win the week. Every episode, just 15 to 20 minutes long, every Tuesday through Friday. Subscribe to the Sleeper King Football Podcast on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your pods.
Let's go to the guest hotline. Welcome onto the show, our buddy, Barry Sferluga, for a little State of the Union on DC Sports. Barry, we thought this would be a good time to get you on to go around the horn because there's a little something going on with every team. How are you, man?
Great, man. Glad to do it.
So we're going to start with off the beaten path here. We were just talking about this kind of out of nowhere on the show, but Sunday I'm sitting down to watch Sunday Night Football, and I'm not a bring back the name, bring back the logo guy, just as a caveat. But I am a, wait, we're still doing this guy. Which was, at the beginning of the telecast, NBC is essentially putting over the vibes at Arrowhead Stadium as the Chiefs are running out onto the field to the tomahawk chop being done by 70,000 people. What do you make of that not only still existing, but essentially being celebrated after the Commanders have now become the Commanders with the Block W and, you know, are afraid to put the Redskins logo on a Daryl Green jersey from the past?
I find it incredibly unsettling, and I'll just take it to a personal level. The 2021 World Series was between the Braves and the Astros, and I remember getting to Truist Field out there outside of Atlanta and kind of bracing for their version of the chop, which is essentially the same as the Chiefs' version of the chop. And I know, Danny, you talked about this a little bit. I found it even that much closer to the summer of 2020 when there was all that unrest during the pandemic across the country, which was the timing of when the Washington NFL team decided to ultimately or was forced to ultimately change its name. I kind of thought, aren't we done with this kind of, you know, painting a group in one way? And I'm with you. I don't want to preach about it. I don't want to say you should think a certain way. I just find, you know, whatever it is, 70,000 people at Arrowhead Stadium or 40,000 people at Truist Park doing this chant that is very evocative of a certain kind of painting with a broad brush of a whole subset of culture, very, very weird. And yes, Grant, I'm willing to stitch it to what you're willing to stitch it to, which is, well, if the team here had to change its name, why are the broadcast partners of these leagues celebrating what's essentially a similar behavior and similar stereotyping in other markets?
Yeah, I think it's well said. I mean, it's I think Grant brought this point up earlier, Barry, and I just want to get your thought on this before we move to the next topic here in our informal Around the Horn. But there's a difference between you can't stop people from singing Hail to the Redskins at the football games, right? I mean, they're just people going to do what they want to do. You have a couple beers, you celebrate the touchdown, you sing the song you knew as a kid. You probably can't stop the Braves fans, probably can't stop the Chiefs fans, no matter how many announcements you make or whatever, from doing the thing they want to do. It's the let's zoom in the camera to the guy that's banging the drum, and then Mike Tirico, who I love, by the way, sort of gleefully saying, like, check out this atmosphere, as if to say, like, welcome to the show. That, to me, is the part I just can't abide. Your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, it one thing to happen organically, and you can question the people who would want to do it organically, and another part to make it, you know, another way to make it officially part of the program. Like, this is what we do. We lead you down this path, 70,000 slightly inebriated people. How are you supposed to respond? I find that curious at best and questionable for sure. You guys talked a little bit about the Indians switching to the Guardians, which was not, my understanding is correct, as forced a nature as the Redskins switching to the Washington Football Team, but it was an acknowledgement of this ridiculous smiley-faced mascot and the name that accompanies it feels outdated. Let's move on. Let's move on as a group. And guess what? The Guardians don't have a Chief Nakahoma with a Tom out there anymore. They've moved on completely. I think that's more. I'm with you, Danny. Like, let's not try to make everybody robots and everybody think the same way, but let's not also program these outdated things into the evening.
Barry Svrluga of the Washington Post. So you've been writing a lot lately about all the different teams, and we can go through some of those pieces, but I want to start with the Juan Soto contract, who you covered here in D.C., from really two perspectives. One, what a game changer this is for Major League Baseball and every owner in the sport, but then also what it means for Nats fans who see another one of their stars go to an arch rival for the balance of his career as they wait to see if, you know, their ownership group is going to give them Anthony Rizzo or if he's out of their price range.
I mean, there's so many tentacles to this. One, and you and I, Grant, have texted about this, $765 million I did not see coming. Now, I do not think that that number in the end retroactively gives the Learners a pass on what I had always argued, that Juan Soto, 2.5 years from free agency, should have been offered at least $500 million over 13, 14, or 15 years, because at that point there was no Ohtani deal. At that point, he could have gotten hurt at some point before free agency. At that point, you would have been asking him to make an historic bet on himself, and turning down $500 million at that time, I think, is a lot harder than turning down the $440 that he did. I had GMs at the time being like, wow, $440 million sounds like a lot, but if you think of it in that perspective, in that timing, there was no way he was going to accept that. So I'm not going to give the Learners a pass for not going further at that time. I also think you're right that the fact that it's the Mets matters. The fact that it's the Mets matters and hurts more for Nats fans than if he had stayed a Yankee. The Yankees are supposed to do Yankee things. The Mets just did a Yankee thing. And the fact that the Mets did that and he will now play you 13 times a year as opposed to just three in one park or the other, that he's going to be in D.C. three times a season for a series, that matters. That's more painful because I believe in the player. I believe he earned that money. I believe at least through the first 8, 9, 10 years of that deal, he's going to perform in accordance to what he's getting paid. I think that's a lot to stomach for Nats fans.
Barry Svrluga of the Post with us here on G&D. So long question incoming, Barry, so bear with me. Apologies. The Kyle Finnegan, to me, is the window into what's going on here with the Nationals. A baseball argument could be made both to have kept him after the trade deadline and to have traded him. I would have traded him, but I could hear somebody saying, hey, wait, you know, we need some of these kids to get more of these wins and validate some things. We need him to close. It's more important to us. We're not going to get what we want in trade. Let's keep him. I'd have traded him, but I understand that's a baseball perspective. Then it's a baseball perspective to say, well, I don't want to sign him for a massive pay increase because of his ancillary numbers and his value. He kind of outkicked his coverage a little bit. That's fine, too. When we get what we got, though, which is you didn't trade him and you didn't keep him, it tells you business people and baseball people either weren't speaking or something changed or something else. I don't see a positive outcome there. To me, this is a window into where this organization is right now. Would love your thoughts.
I don't disagree at all, and the only caveat I would say is if a month from now we're talking about the $8.5-9 million, whatever Kyle Finnegan would have made in arbitration as a 38-save guy last year, if that money and more money has been reallocated to pick one, a power-hitting first baseman, a DH with power, somebody who can plug third base until Brady House comes up, a number one or number two or number three, some veteran starting pitcher, more bullpen help. If that money and more has been reallocated and you say, hey, we paid, we jettisoned Kyle Finnegan, but we replaced him with players A, B, C, and D that address needs 1, 2, 3, and 4, and our payroll has now increased from nothing, flat zero, we're paying zero players, to, okay, now we have some veterans around that are making $10 million more a year, and that's augmenting the core that we have, then you've executed a strategy. What you've articulated and what is apparent to this point is not a strategy. Trading Hunter Harvey, whose all underlying numbers were better than Finnegan's, he throws harder, he has a higher whiff rate, fewer fly balls, fewer homers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They got a pick and a player for Hunter Harvey a couple of weeks before the deadline because they were aggressive. That's how you execute at the deadline. What they did with Finnegan in both not trading him and not keeping him, as you described, is odd, unless we've got moves to come, and there better be moves to come.
Yeah. So let's get there with you, Barry. 2025 is coming quickly, right? I mean, it's not going to be long before we see you in West Palm Beach. And I get it. It's only been a few weeks. Only five of the top, you know, 50 free agents or whatever have found homes. It's very early. But we are reading some tea leaves. You talk to people. I talk to people. You see the reports from the people who do this for a living. The Nats are not really swimming in what I'm calling the ponds where the big fish are, okay? I mean, they are not linked to the stars. They have nobody on their books at this point who makes any money. Their highest paid player is Luis Garcia and K-Bert Ruiz after him. Then I think it's Mackenzie Gore, Derek Law, JoJo Gray, who's not even going to pitch this year, and no one else makes $1 million. Their payroll, you may have a better number than I do, but is effectively between $30 and $35 million on actual players who are going to be on the team. That's the Marlins. That's the A's, right? So I say all this to ask you, what should we be expecting this offseason? I think it was Andrew Golden in the Post last night, your colleague who does an awesome job covering the beat and getting the news on this team, suggested they like Christian Walker, which I've been hearing for months. I think they got baseball guys that really, really like him, which is great, but that maybe he's going to be too rich for them. Well, if he's too rich for them, that's like tier two among power bats. The next tier down is like Anthony Rizzo or Paul Goldschmidt. I mean, do I have to start preparing myself for that?
I think there's a chance, Grant, because I do think they're in that 2011 mode where they've regressed to the point, and at that point they hadn't built up yet to the point where, you know, they're not viewed as a legitimate contender. Particularly, go back to the Soto discussion, I mean, they now swim in a pond where Steve Cohen will spend any amount of money to get any player, where the Phillies have already shown that they can spend $300 million on more than one player, and where the Braves have signed team-friendly long-term deals to some of their better young players. Like, that's a tough pond to swim in. But if you go back to that 2011 deal, and I've talked for the past couple of years about, you know, they went and got Jason Worth a year before or year or two before anybody thought like they would be able to fish in that kind of stream. And the only reason they did it, and Jason Worth would tell you this, is, you know, they went a year and, you know, X million dollars more than the Boston Red Sox, who were the other suitor there. They are now in position where they would have to overpay. Do you overpay for Christian Walker, who, well, he has, he's great defensively and has a little bit of the pop that you're looking for, particularly at first base. I know there are some people that view him as a declining player. Is the third or fourth year of that deal nowhere near what the first year is? And if you are overpaying and you're adding a year on because you have to overpay to a declining player, that gives you more of the decline and less of the prime. It's a very, very difficult spot. And more to your point, and this is where it's disappointing to me, I think that they should be in the discussions for a Corbin Burns or a Max Fried, like the top of the rotation free agents that are out there. That would bump everybody back into a more comfortable role. If you could say to Mackenzie Gore, you don't have to be the ace. Pitch to your abilities. You're number two or number three. Cade Cavalli, when you saw, you know, they would have so much rotation depth if you add one 180, 190, 200 inning guy. And it's disappointing to me that Mike Rizzo, who believes in starting pitching being the foundation of your club, is not being allowed financially to go pursue the best starting pitcher that's out there.
Barry, I want to shift gears to the Capitals. I thought they'd be better, but I guess I would say mildly skeptical that they would be the best team in the NHL, but I don't think anybody saw this coming, maybe even internally. Just try to quantify this for us. What are we seeing here year over year?
It's just jaw-dropping, Danny, and I'd say it's delightfully jaw-dropping. I mean, I said to some of the people with the team when they went out west, like, you couldn't have paid me to stay up past 10 p.m. to watch one of their 2-1 slugfests in Vegas last year. Like, it's just not worth the time. And I found myself, when they were in Vegas and Utah and Colorado, like, not being able to turn the TV off after midnight. I did some digging on this in terms of year-over-year goal scoring, and this goes back to last week, but I think it holds up. Before the Toronto-Montreal swing, they were averaging a league-best 4.08 goals per game. That's up from 2.63 goals per game, which ranked 28th in the league a year ago. The NHL and the Caps ran the numbers for me. To find an increase year-over-year, and we haven't gone through 82 games of the schedule, but to find an increase year-over-year for one team to increase by what amounted to, I think, 1.45 goals a game, you had to go back to 1970-71, the Boston Bruins back then. Right now, you're looking at a historic offensive improvement. It has to be sustained. The good news is that even if they don't score 4 goals a night, they're playing really good defense. They're getting decent goaltending. And I think one conclusion you have to draw is that Brian McClellan and Chris Patrick had a whiteboard in Vegas where they were drawing up their plans for free agency. They had boxes they wanted to check. They checked every single one of those boxes in a way that formed a lineup that Spencer Carberry, who I believe is proving to be a very top-notch coach, could fit his lineup together personally, both skill-wise and personality-wise. And right now you're seeing a complete team with 4 lines and 3 strong defensive pairings that I think we're moving past the point where we're saying this is a really good start to saying this is a really good team.
Yeah, they're number one in some of the power rankings I look at now, ranking all the NHL teams, and they're tied for the most points in the National Hockey League. You can read Barry's work in the Washington Post. Before we let you go, final minute here, but we'd be remiss if we didn't come back and actually mention football in a between-the-lines sense. The Commanders come out of the bye, Barry. 4 games to go here against the Saints, the Eagles, and then the Falcons and Cowboys. How many wins do you see there, and do you think 10-7 would get them in, or do you think they've got to get to 11?
I feel pretty comfortable that 10-7 gets them in. I also feel fairly comfortable that they'll get to 11. And maybe I'm overreading into the get right game against what was the Tennessee Titans. But yeah, you've mentioned that New Orleans is playing better and under an interim head coach. They're still quarterbacked who they're quarterbacked by, and the Commanders still have Jaden Daniels and a bunch of weapons. I feel like the Falcons are going in the wrong direction. That feels like a very vulnerable team. And the Cowboys, if they need that game in Dallas in week 18, I mean, who would you rather be playing than that dumpster fire at that point? So it's weird to be kind of feeling overconfident about a Washington football team in December, because that's such an, you know, it's just an unfamiliar feeling around here. But I not only think they get to 10, I think, you know, we could be looking at the first 11-win season since the last Super Bowl year, which is astonishing to say. And then, you know, take your chances in the playoffs. You're going to play on the road, but if the draw is Seattle or Tampa or Atlanta or whatever, you've got a chance. If it's in Philly, that's a little bit tougher, I think. But just amazing that we can sit here weeks before Christmas and be like, oh, let's talk about playoff seeding. That's kind of neat.
Yeah, no doubt. Barry, awesome as always, man. Good to catch up with you.
Appreciate it, guys. Anytime.
Barry Sferluga, outstanding. Check him out in the Washington Post.